Welcome back to Killing Time, the podcast. This is episode 5 of Murder in the Morning. A desperate Fotis Doulos confronts the reality that time and money are running out to keep him from facing trial and possible prison time for the murder of his missing wife, Jennifer Farber Doulos. There's only one final solution left. We pick up the story with a stunning twist. Here's Cynthia Fagan and Pamela K. Brown.
All I want to say is that I wish Jennifer and her family happy holidays. And I just pray that they give my kids my love and my best wishes.
That's Fotis Doulos outside a Connecticut courthouse in early December 2019, after he failed to wrest control of his 5 children's substantial trust funds. It was in excess of $10 million.
Pam, he actually said that with a straight face. He sent holiday greetings to his dead wife. Jennifer has been missing for 8 months. Imagine how much pain and anguish he has caused the Farber family. Well, he's the number one suspect.
Yeah, it's very telling, isn't it?
It certainly is.
Fotis is wishing Jennifer well while knowing she is dead. We talked to Farber family attorney Richard Weinstein, who deposed and faced off against Fotis in civil court.
With his predatory nature trying to get at Gloria because she had sufficient funds, do you think he was trying to raid his children's trust funds?
That's a very good question. I will say that he and his lawyers were very interested in trying to determine the nature and extent of Hilliard Farber's estate, the nature and extent of the assets the children had. And of course, I was concerned that he was trying to latch on to the trust funds of the children.
It's early January 2020. The pandemic is not yet in full throttle. Let's set the scene for our main characters. The detectives from Connecticut State Police have been unable to find the body of Jennifer Farber Doulos, nor have they found a murder weapon. Chief State Medical Examiner Dr. James Gill has officially determined that Jennifer is a homicide victim, or, in the parlance of forensic pathologists, quote, a homicide of violence.
Dr. Gill based this conclusion that there was so much blood evidence found at Jennifer's home in New Canaan and in the trash cans in Hartford that Jennifer had sustained an injury or multiple injuries that would be, quote, non-survivable without medical intervention. Meanwhile, Pam, Jennifer and Fotis's 5 children are living full-time now with their grandmother, Gloria Farber, at her New York City apartment, a very swanking apartment near Central Park. The children's beloved nanny, Lauren Almeida, the one who discovered the crime scene at the New Canaan house, is still very much a part of the children's lives. However, Fotis is not allowed to visit the kids by order of the court.
The big concern there, and a concern that Jennifer had throughout the divorce proceedings, was that he could possibly abduct the children.
Because he was always trying to take their passports. His girlfriend slash mistress was, you know, had ties to South America, and he would say things, right? You know, he would say things. You know, abduction, parental abduction, taking children into countries where extradition is difficult.
Well, that was a very constant ongoing concern that we had. But he had, a number of times threatened to Jennifer that he would leave and take the children. So it was a very real fear on her part.
Back in Farmington, Connecticut, Fotis is out on a $6 million bail bond. He wears an ankle monitor and he rattles around by himself at the 11,000 square foot 4 Jefferson Crossing mansion. Remember, this is the same house where he had lived with Jennifer and the kids, and where he also had his 4 group office.
And that's the same house that he tried to move his lover, Michelle Traconis, into while Jennifer and the kids were still living there. Jennifer packed up and fled that marriage, filing for divorce in June 2017. Michelle and her teenage daughter moved in. Perhaps it was more a viper's nest than a love nest.
This is an important date. On January 23rd, 2020, Fotis was running out of time and money to stay out of jail while awaiting trial. His attorney, Norm Pattis, continued to push a bizarre conspiracy theory that Jennifer had staged her own disappearance to get back at Fotis. Listen here.
Let me break it down. No one knows where Jennifer is. The state is trying to put together a case that Mr. Doulos is responsible for that murder or for that disappearance. And we take the position there's insufficient evidence to conclude that she's even dead.
That's pretty ballsy.
Yeah, but wait, there's more. While out on that $6 million bail bond, Fotis is dragged back to court for desecrating a makeshift memorial to Jennifer near his home. Just listen to Norm Pattis spin this one into making Fotis sound like the victim.
Imagine you woke up one night in the face of a missing loved one with whom you may have been engaged in some court-related hostilities. The world thought you were the person responsible for the loved one's disappearance, and they began to place items on your lawn or close to your home. Do you leave them there and say all is fair in love and war, or do you remove them? Yeah, I'm worried about the public perception.
At this moment, even Norm Pattis knows it's not a good look for his client to trash a memorial to Jennifer.
First, we don't know that there was a memorial. We know that items were placed, candles, wreaths, and so forth, in close proximity to his home with an aim to tell him, you know, whatever it is these folks wanted to tell him. You'll have to ask the people who reported items missing.
At the same time, Fotis' lover, Michelle Draconis, is out of his life forever as she faces her own litany of charges. Michelle's attorney, John Schoenhorn.
So it's very topsy-turvy for her, an emotional roller coaster. She's on the news, her mugshot is constantly being shown. It's very upsetting. This is not something she's familiar with. She's not even familiar with the kind of paparazzi type reaction that everything she does, everything I file, every time she goes to court, everyone in the world not only wants to know, but then there are all these snarky, you know, online trolls that constantly are harassing and berating her. They're creating fake online profiles with her name to make it look like their posts by her when they're not.
And as for the third player in Jennifer's disappearance in January 2020, Fotis' pal, attorney Kent Mawhinney, is already sitting behind bars.
Mr. Mawhinney is a former lawyer, was and is facing charges of sexually assaulting his wife, which under Connecticut law, you know, it's a crime. It's a domestic violence crime. It's a sexual assault in a spousal or cohabitation situation. He was facing those charges.
Connecticut State Police slapped additional charges on Mawhinney that he conspired with Fotis and Michelle to kill Jennifer. Like Michelle Draconis, Kent Mawhinney has pled not guilty to all charges. But Schoenhorn thinks Mawhinney has already cut a deal and will be a witness for the prosecution.
Oh, boy.
If a person in jail, for any reason, cooperates with law enforcement, they are considered a jailhouse informant and therefore worthy of less belief, less credibility than another person who gives information.
Now, in the midst of his legal nightmare, Fotis suddenly renews a decades-old friendship with 42-year-old Anna Curry. She is a wealthy North Carolina financial advisor, and she stays with him in Farmington at the 4 Jefferson Crossing Mansion. Curry is apparently such a good friend, she shells out $147,000 of her own money and promises to pay an additional $272,000 towards Fotis' whopping $6 million bail.
Wow, that's some friend. Tuesday morning, January 28th, Fotis has a noon appearance before the court in Stamford, Connecticut. He knows there is a possibility his bond could be revoked and he could immediately be sent to prison to await trial for murder. But Fotis has made other plans.
Between 9:53 and 10:59 a.m., Fotis makes 4 phone calls. The first 2 are to his bail bondsman. The next one is at 10:45 a.m. to one of his attorneys, Kevin Smith, a law partner of Norm Pattis. Smith reminds him it's crucial to be there before noon for the hearing.
Cynthia, for our audience, you have to remember that Stamford is about an hour's drive from Farmington.
And the last call is at 10:59 a.m. when Fotis speaks with his new gal pal, Anna Curry. She's at the bank withdrawing cash. They agree to meet up at the courthouse. It's almost noon now. Fotis is a no-show. He's not answering his phone.
Where the hell could he possibly be? Here's Farmington Police Lieutenant Tim McKenzie.
Today at about 11:54 hours this morning, officers from the Farmington Police Department were asked to respond to Mr. Dulos' residence for a well-being check because he was late for a court appearance today. When officers responded, they could see through a window that Mr. Dulos was sitting in his vehicle and he had obvious signs of medical distress. Officers forced entry and immediately began to perform life-saving measures. Mr. Dulos was transported to Yukon Health by ambulance, where he is now listed as critical condition.
What is very strange that day is that Anna had briefly stopped back at the Jefferson Crossing mansion before heading to court to meet Fotis. She had no idea that when she left for Stamford, Fotis was in the garage, slumped and unconscious in the front seat of his Chevy Suburban with the motor running. The crime scene revealed that Fotis had stuffed styrofoam under the garage door, disabled the carbon monoxide detector, and duct taped a vacuum cleaner hose to the tailpipe to breathe in the toxic fumes.
Wow, our story begins in a garage and it ends in a garage. The bail bondsman and Anna Curry later tell police that during their phone conversation with Fotis, he sounded like he was, quote, out of breath, or, quote, sounded like he was working out.
I don't have the exact time of when they determined whether or not Mr. Dulos had any signs of life.
Farber family attorney Richard P. Weinstein told us the suicide attempt was all about Fotis being in control. And when one is in jail, you're not in control.
Oh, in my mind, there's very little doubt that his suicide was prompted by the fact that he knew that the real estate values had been inflated, that he would not be able to make bond or maintain the bond, and that the chances were substantial that he was going back to prison. And I believe that's what triggered his suicide.
Back at the garage, now a crime scene, police find on the passenger seat of the Chevy Suburban Fotis' defiant suicide note. It's dated January 28th, neatly handwritten in block print on a single sheet of lined notebook paper. On the dashboard, there are photographs of Fotis with his kids.
All, if you are reading this, I am no more. I refuse to spend even an hour more in jail for something I had nothing to do with. Enough is enough. If it takes my head to end this, so be it. I want it to be known that Michelle Draconis had nothing to do with Jennifer's disappearance, and neither did Ken Mowinney. I ask the state to let them free of any such accusations. I also ask the state to stop harassing my friends Andreas Tutazarius and Anna Curry. They are honorable people. Please let my children know that I love them. I would do anything to be with them. But unfortunately, we all have our limits. The state will not rest until I rot in jail. My attorney can explain what happened with the bags on Albany Avenue. Everything else is a story fabricated by law enforcement. I want to thank all my family and friends that stood by me this difficult time. Above all, Anna Curry, I am sorry for letting you down and not continuing the fight. Fotis.
2 days later, Fotis' attorney, Norm Pattis, gathers the press.
Fotis Dulos was declared dead tonight at 5:32. His family came in from Greece and decided today to donate his organs so that he will live on in some form in the assistance that he can provide to others in their own individual struggles. The family is adamant that his name be cleared, and as to those who contend that Mr. Dulos' death reflects a consciousness of guilt, we say no. We say it was more a conscience overborne with the weight of a world that was too busy to listen and that wanted a story more than it wanted the truth. And we're not bitter, and we're not accusing anybody of having driven him to his death. But we wonder why, in the court of public opinion, the presumption of innocence was so quickly satisfied.
For Jennifer's best friend, Carrie Luft, there was something glaringly missing from the suicide note.
And when he finally decided to end his own life, there was no letter. No, kids, forgive me. No kind words, you know, last words of wisdom or love, nothing.
Yes, that's definitely bewildering, and somehow the absence speaks volumes. You know, I do have to say again, I very much want to try to protect the kids' privacy. Mm-hmm. And they have, you know, they have a lot of delightful memories of times with their dad.
Five children now confront their future without their parents and the knowledge that their father is most likely their mother's killer.
Horrible, horrible situation that none of us ever expected to find ourselves in. And you just have to keep going. You know, the children's lives are very urgent in a way that adult lives aren't.
Former Deputy Hartford Police Chief Brian Foley says it's a nightmare for all families when the bodies of loved ones are not recovered.
In this case, there's still no final closure for the family. What does that tell you for closure for a family to actually find the remains of their loved one?
Well, you know, we got out of saying there's closure for the family a long time ago. When an arrest is made, you know, it's tough to ever bring closure, as they say. It may help victims cope better knowing that and be able to internally get through it and survive. The lack of a body, lack of a victim, certainly makes it exponentially harder to process internally. As with any homicide case, it's never over. Like when you make an arrest of a suspect or suspects, the homicide detectives don't spike the football, do a dance in the end zone, and button up the case and put it in a file. The case is always working, especially in ones where there's no, when the victim has not been found. It never goes away.
It's been a year since Fotis's suicide, but the search for Jennifer continues. We talked to a man who specializes in finding the remains of the dead.
Well, according to what I was told is that the body could have been dismembered and buried in different locations. And so that's why we kind of alerted to the area.
That's Robert Perry. In January 2021, Connecticut State Police hired him. He's also known as the Bone Finder. He runs a cemetery mapping service using ground-penetrating radar, but he also helps cops find human remains of murder victims. Well, let me ask you this, Bob, because I know that you deal with settling the dead, and also, but you have a chance here, and you have proven yourself in helping families find closure when a loved one is missing and presumed murdered. So, what do you hope happens here for Jennifer?
Well, I hope they resolve the case because it's tragic.
Bob, in the case of what brought you to 80 Mountain Spring Road, right? Who called and said, "Bob, we need you"?
Well, first of all, it was the state police that contacted me, and they. What happened was that there was a lady or the mother of the murdered victim,
Mrs. Farber.
She heard of me and what it is that I do, and because I'm pretty well known in the industry, and so anyway, she asked the state police to have me call me and have me come in, and to scan the area, and that's how it all started.
Bob, can you describe the machine, or it's not like on a roller? Is that it?
Yeah, and what it is, it's like a baby carriage. It looks like a baby carriage, and I can collapse it down. I can take it with me. I can actually fit it right in my back seat. But it has two 18-inch wheels in the back, and then one 18-inch wheel in the front. And just below, between the two wheels, there's a antenna on the bottom. Between the two wheels, suspended. And with this, and then what happens is that that antenna drags across the ground. That is a transmitter and receiver down there. And then there's that transmitter and receiver is hooked up to a line of cables to a computer that sits on top of the handlebars.
Bob's machine can see to a depth of 20 feet.
If I'm looking for an old grave, and that's not in any sort of container or anything in that nature there, a lot of times the only thing I'm picking up may be the skull, because it may be collapsed, or maybe the skull, the chest cavity, possibly. Very seldom do you find you can actually pick up any anomalies showing bones or anything in that nature, you know, legs or something like that. Typically it's a chest cavity, or I'm picking up the skull. You know, it's picking up the skull area, because that's an anomaly that would be recognizable by the radar.
Bob, how many hours did you spend at the Mountain Spring home in Farmington looking for Jennifer?
Well, I was there. I got there at about 11 o'clock. I got there by 11 o'clock, and I was there till about maybe 3, I think it was. So I wasn't there that long.
Remember, this mansion is located on a 5-acre wooded lot. This is where Fotis and Michelle spent hours on the day of Jennifer's disappearance cleaning the red Toyota Tacoma pickup truck. Police believe this was one of the vehicles used to transport Jennifer's body.
That evening, the couple were caught on camera as Fotis dumps bloody evidence, including clothing belonging to Jennifer, in Hartford's public trash cans. But where is Jennifer?
So what I'm looking for there is I'm looking for anomalies or disturbed soil within positive areas, and what I'm looking for is, like, I call it scrambled eggs. It looks like it shows collapsedness on the ground, and it just looks like if you looked at a plate of scrambled eggs, that's what it looks like on the computer screen. I look for anomalies within the soil disturbance, a bone or a skull, and there was two areas in the woods there that were just about the size of a grave. It's been disturbed. The rocks were moved out of the way, but it was very muddy. And so I indicated that this would be an area that we should be digging, this one here. And then there was another one next to, a little further down. But then the state police pointed out an area probably 50 feet away that they wanted me to scan. It was a kind of a real wet area, and so I went over and I scanned that area, and everything turned out to be low probability, at least in my report.
Could he have taken a backhoe, just dug as deep as possible, thrown the body of Jennifer in, and then covered it up, and your radar machine might not detect it?
Well, the unit that I run is a 400 megahertz, and it's capable of scanning to about 20 feet.
Bob was directed by the Connecticut State Police to search a particular area. It was where a potential home buyer once asked a very nervous Fotis about where he could install a pool.
They were looking to put in a pool. And then when the surveyors were out there in the back and they were looking at the area, the gentleman that owned the property there was kind of a little nervous or something like that when they were out there. And the surveyors directed me to go in these particular areas and to look for. And in addition to those, I scanned some other areas that had you know, possibility, but nothing again was found.
Then Bob was directed by the state police to scan the basement of the mansion.
In the basement, there was an area below the stair casing. It was probably right below the stair casing, and there was cement. There was already cement down there. I guess they dug something up in that particular spot or whatever it was, or it could have been a grave.
Nothing was found by Bob the Bone Finder in the short search on the 5 acres. For Jennifer's family and friends, it was another letdown. Carrie Luft.
Yes. I mean, we were relieved that they undertook that search. You know, obviously, we're still desperate for them to find Jennifer. So when the investigators undertook this most recent search, they were operating with a whole lot of new and different information. So, it made sense that they would search that property. And, you know, of course, we were disappointed that it did not yield what we wanted it to.
John Schoenhorn is not surprised that the state police came away empty-handed. He insists that his client, Michelle Tracones, did nothing wrong. So, in essence, do you think this is a story that your client has been framed by dirty cops?
I'm not going to go that far. Let me tell you what, if you want my theory, I believe that the police truly want to solve the mystery of what happened to Jennifer Doulos. They have spent millions of dollars, and I'm not exaggerating, millions of dollars trying to determine what happened to her. So I believe they really wanted to solve this crime or solve the mystery of what happened. And they assumed that Michelle Traconis had information more than she actually did, and she was trying to help them. But after Fotis Doulos took his life last year, she's basically, they need to explain why they spent these millions of dollars. So that's why they're going after her. And I believe that police think that it's okay to cut corners, violate people's civil rights, just because they figured, well, she's not going to be their target.
Coming up on episode 6 of Killing Time, the podcast, did a broken family court system hurt Jennifer as she tried in vain to divorce Fotis before her murder?
Why did Jennifer go to a courtroom? Because she couldn't negotiate with her abuser.
Divorce attorney, sometime along the road, they lose their mind.
Where is she? Where is she?
And Pamela and Cynthia return to the park where our story, Murder in the Morning, began.
If you want to take a body out of a car and hide it. Right. It's great camouflage.
In plain sight.
In plain sight.
That's coming up on episode 6 of Killing Time, the podcast.